Here's your host, Craig Routson, with today's topic.
And good morning. Our guests today in the studio, we have two of them. We're going to have one on the phone a little later. We have Lisa Shuttle. She is a clinical therapist with the Thamaria Psychological Services of Cass City. Also, we're going to be speaking with Mary Greibel. She's a survivor of suicide and volunteers to speak around the area as she has firsthand information about what people are going to go through. And it's not pretty. So thanks for being with us. It's a sensitive topic. We're hearing more and more about it, it seems. And, you know, as we learn more, hopefully we can come to grips with what's going on and find a way to prevent some of this. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
I understand this is a special month.
Yes, this is September is Suicide Awareness Month, and in Huron County, the Huron County Suicide Prevention Coalition, along with several community groups, church groups, we're putting on several presentations, or three presentations that we'd like to talk about here today. And I know joining us on the phone pretty soon here will be Ted Swartz. He is presenting Laughter is Sacred Space at Lakers School, and this came about by collaboration with Pigeon Mennonite Church and Huron County Suicide Prevention Coalition, and many community support groups are involved in this, collaborating to bring him here. Everyone for Prevention is, they're really instrumental in the funding, most of the funding for him to come. And what it is they reach teens by anti-drug, anti-alcohol, anti-tobacco, pro-health. They provide a buffer in the community. So it's through their funding that Ted is able to come. But Laughter and Sacred, or Is Sacred Space, is a program that he puts on across the country. He's a comedic actor, and his business partner of 20 years had died by suicide in 2007.
It seems like an odd combination, laughter and talking about suicide. I mean, absolutely. It doesn't go together, but mm-hmm. He seems to make it work.
He makes it work. I've not heard his presentation, and I know that, Mary had Mary herself here as a survivor. And Mary, what was your response when initially you thought, oh, Laughter Sacred Space, when you had heard about his story?
When I first heard what they were planning on presenting, I was dead set against it. I said, no, there's no place in suicide talks for laughter. There's nothing funny about the subject. Then I learned a little bit about Ted and realized that they did a comic act together, and he's just showing us how he survived the death of his partner.
And this is something everybody does individually. There's no formula for survivors. You have to find your own way. You can get help from others, but you have to come to terms with it on your own.
It's a jungle. It's truly a jungle. It's a hard, hard journey that you walk when you lose somebody by suicide.
Is the first part anger?
Because
sometimes,
always.
How can you do this, and you're hurting. And, there's often a feeling of lashing out at that point.
There's definitely different stages of grief that people can go through, but they're not always chronological, and they're not complete. Anger, first shock, denial, bartering, anger, depression, and then acceptance. But acceptance isn't that your grief has ended or stopped. Acceptance is you realize definitely the permanency of the situation. It's fully set into you. And, it's about trying to restore hope or going on to live your life. But I'm certain Mary can attest to the compounded grief, or the very, very deep grief associated with suicide specifically.
I myself have not experienced any anger towards my son at all. I know a lot of people do experience anger. Some of Matt's friends were angry at him. There was some anger, but it didn't come from me. My pain was so great, I ended up being diagnosed as having complicated grief. My pain and my sorrow was just overshadowed everything else. And I think my length of time in the shock lasted a lot longer than it does for a lot of other people. Everybody's different. They all have different personalities, different connections to the ones that died. And I'm still grieving deeply, you know, after 7 years. But anger is something that I haven't experienced towards him.
Is getting help something that some people don't take advantage of? I mean, it's such a personal thing, you almost to the point where you don't want to tell people, mm-hmm. you know, who don't know. And, you know, if you can find someone, you know, to talk to, I've always heard the first thing to put something into a perspective or into an issue you can handle is to be able to vocalize it to someone else. And when you keep it all internalized, it grows and it grows and it builds. It's an important step to find someone, whether it's a minister, a therapist, somebody who you can talk to?
I found all of them. I ended up in the hospital after my son died, and from there I ended up seeking counseling. I was going every week for a time, and now I still go maybe every 3 or 4 months. I also sought out another group, Compassionate Friends, for parents who have lost a loved one, a child, from any means. I started attending support groups and just reading and researching. I'm an answer seeker. I needed answers. I'm still seeking answers, but now I'm sharing everything that I've learned in the hopes of helping someone else.
And I lead the Huron County Suicide Survivor Support Group, and I mean, we do have small numbers. The pain is so intense, and it is difficult to share when you feel that depth of pain or feel stigmatized. But the group in and of itself is so supportive to people, so they do have an avenue. Individual counseling is so imperative, especially if you're suffering with post-traumatic stress, which is often the case following a suicide, or complicated or confounded grief, just because you're dealing with the suicide of the person, but you're also dealing with personal feelings of guilt or shame or wondering what you could have done to save the person. And often there is no opportunity because oftentimes your loved one will not give you signs. There's definitely signs that you can look for, but they will protect the people around them or not give them signs that they're about to die.
And with the support group, it's broken people reaching out and helping broken people. When you lose somebody by suicide, something inside of you dies, and it's like you're broken, heart, spirit, soul. And if you can share that with someone else that's been through that, they understand. There's an understanding there, more of an openness, not so much shock value because they've all been through it.
We were talking a little bit before, and I think people, before the show, and I think people would be kind of surprised at the age groups that typically, you know, for men and for male and female, that are statistically more prone to suicide.
Sure. The Center for Disease Control's put out these numbers, and the latest numbers are from 2014.
Because it takes time to tabulate and get
yes.
all the records right. in.
And I know we spoke about, and I'll speak about in a minute, about how to get even an accurate account because of how sometimes a suicide's made to look like an accident, or the way it's reported on a death certificate to be sort of protective to the family. So there's different things. But basically in the United States in 2014, well, there's 43,000 suicides approximately each year. And the highest numbers for men are in the 45 to 64 year old age group, which is sort of shocking for people because you think of teens or young adults. But for females, which I think this would be pretty shocking, females it's age 10 to 14. And you might not, you know, as a parent, you're probably not considering that your young daughter could be even having those thoughts, you know, at 10, 11, 12 years old. So that's why awareness and education is so important.
Well, the younger ones for the girls, to me, I'm thinking, maybe it's peer pressure, maybe it's, you know, trying to conform to what the peers want, and mm-hmm. and it gets difficult, and there's nothing more that a 10 to 14-year-old kid wants to do is to fit in. And when they feel they don't, it seems like that could be a recipe for problems.
Absolutely. Fifth, sixth, seventh grade, tough.
And teenagers, to begin with, their moods and everything change from when they were small children, so you may not recognize it as a sign. You think, oh, they're a teenager, and they're just sulking in their room because I told them to wash the dishes, and it has nothing to do with that.
Right, exactly that, because teens already exhibit maybe some withdrawal from you, isolating themselves, moodiness, like you were just saying. So, you know, you're not always going to anticipate that they may consider suicide. I know Mary has been through several trainings and speaks, you know, to several different student groups. Maybe you could speak about that, or different at junior highs throughout the county.
I go through with the health department. I volunteer and speak in health classes to the students, and I share with them, my topic is what suicide does to those left behind. And I share pretty much everything about my son's story, and they write notes to me afterwards. They don't have to put their names, they can or they don't have to. And I'm amazed at how many students from 8th grade through 12th grade have actually contemplated suicide.
And is there a difference between, you know, passing thought and
acting,
contemplating?
On it?
I mean, there's, you know, everyone's, but there, and then there's actual, you know, what would it be like without me? Would it be better? Is there like a threshold in there that people need to worry about, you know, if I'm crossing this?
Yeah, it's so hard to draw where that line is. For sure, the term suicide ideation, you know, I'd rather not be here, I'd rather not be on the planet, I don't want to go through this anymore. Maybe you have an ideal, or you have ideation about it, but, you know, actual plan and planning out, sometimes people can plan for a very long time, and we try to, as clinicians, assess for risk factors, but, you know, you can't always know. And then there's always those suicides that are acts of passion, like in the moment, no anticipation really about that, but you can't really know. And so you just have to really directly ask the person, are you thinking about suicide? Are you going to kill yourself? Like, you, as a parent, as, you know, a friend or teen, I know you speak to that in the schools about how should they address their friends who have said, don't tell anybody, but I'm thinking about this.
And I tell them, don't keep secrets. Your friend may be angry with you for telling, but once they get their life back and realize that they really want to live, they're not going to be angry anymore. But I tell them to be a friend. If you see somebody that's acting strange, that's giving away their things, that's not participating in what they've done before, ask them, what's wrong? Can I help you? Are you thinking about suicide? And get help for them right away, because you can't take care of it yourself. You need to bring an adult into the situation, whether as a parent, a church leader, a teacher, a counselor, find somebody and just keep asking.
Is a person likely to tell you if they are? I mean, is that really, you know, you talked about the parents, you know, asking their kids if they're thinking this way. All I could see was some girl rolling her eyes back, Mom!
Like, no, right.
You know what I mean? Even if they are, because that would be the reaction, you know, I'm not going to say anything about it. If you're thinking your kid has this, is this like the first step that maybe you better make sure they're not, you know, take other steps?
Right, and they will hide and deceive and all of those things. But I think, you know, even as a therapist, you know, we will often say, or we have to say, you know, everything you say is confidential. Mm-hmm. Unless you tell me you have thoughts of self-harm, you know, and then for sure we're going to have to make sure that you get some help or see about you getting some help. And so, you know, maybe sometimes people are a little hesitant, but I always see almost a look of relief on their face, like, oh, somebody address this with me, because this has been, you know, swimming around in my mind, or I can't stop these thoughts, you know, these thoughts of worthlessness or thoughts of hopelessness. And so to bring it out, to address the elephant in the room the best you can. Yep, teenagers are moody, they might shut you down, but I would definitely ask the question. And as far as, you know, the male group, I'm sure there's a lot of studies on this, sociology of why this is 45 to 64. And, you know, I don't know if it's the economy or, you know, personal pressures, but like, why why this age group specifically, just, you know, that hopelessness and despair.
You have the midlife crisis, you have the looking forward to retirement, which may not be what you want. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of things coming up, life-changing things.
Right.
That, you know, maybe
goals
maybe,
not met. Life
that maybe they don't want to face.
Yeah, you start to go through a life review maybe, and, you know, what you weren't able to achieve or disappointments, regrets that you have. So really, Suicide Awareness Month for sure is about, okay, how is it that we can remove the stigma from people getting help for mental health issues? I know we have three events, but Mary was going to talk about the Walk for Awareness, which I know you were so instrumental in organizing.
Our Walk for Awareness is actually this Saturday, and it used to be said for every suicide death, there's six other people that are directly affected, and they've changed that number now to 115, and I believe it could even be more than that, because anybody that knew you, was related to you, went to school with you, worked with you, are affected by death by suicide. With the walk, it's really survivors reaching out to help other survivors. We're there to offer support and comfort along with resources and let them know we understand. We allow them to get new information. We have speakers come in. We have a wonderful closing ceremony this year with drummers coming in from the metro area. And they hear other stories, stories of hope, how people have survived. They're able to share their stories, share their loved ones. It's just a nice coming together. This is our fifth annual walk, and so far it's been attended very well.
Where is it going to be? What time? And do people need to register, or do you have to, or can you just show up? Because people are going to want to know this.
The walk is this Saturday, September 10th, and registration starts at 9 o'clock in the morning. We do like you to pre-register. It is now too late to order a t-shirt. The fee is $15. That includes walkers, the speaker, the drum ceremony, resources, refreshments there. It's at the Huron County Nature Center up in Oak Beach and Loosemore Road in Caseville. And,
so it's a beautiful place to
work. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. We have the Memorial Garden, which features silhouettes on signs of whether it was a male or a female that died from suicide and their age, and it lines our walk. And we have different fact sheets put up also.
Just bring your bug spray.
You know what?
It's out in the woods.
It's not too bad, though, but we are having a speaker come from New York, Amy, I'm not sure how you pronounce this, Biacolli, from New York, and she's an author and a journalist. She works for the New York Times, I believe. She lost her husband very unexpectedly to suicide also, and she has quite a story to share about her surviving it and her aftermath with her three children.
Do you want us to try and connect with with Ted here and see if we can get him on the phone and talk about his part of the events you have planned for this month?
And he'll do, yeah, absolutely, and he will do an awesome job, I'm sure, explaining how laughter is incorporated. It's really, he talks about the paradox of, you know, obviously laughter and deep, deep sadness about, but experiencing like the absence of God or, you know, having difficulty in his comedic writing following the death. And this is really about his grief journey and how he really touches people.
We'll take a break and then we will come back and see if we can get Ted on the line here.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
I wanted to be in the military since I was a kid.
I served a total of 16 years.
And at 19 years old, that's the first time I ever saw somebody die.
Coming back, I was raging.
I started having pretty horrible nightmares.
I started drinking a lot.
I guess I never recognized it in myself.
It all starts with going to the VA. There's a whole community of veterans that just want to help you out.
It's for the guys who couldn't come back, so you owe it to them to live well, because they're not here with their families.
Visit maketheconnection.net.
We are back in the studio here at WLEW, and we have on the phone our guest is
Ted Schwartz,
and he's going to be doing a performance, and it's the title would make you kind of wonder. It's Laughter is a Sacred Space, and it has to do with suicide. Is that a combination that's difficult to pull off?
Well, I should probably explain where it comes from. I'm an actor and a writer who was working with a partner for almost 20 years creating comedy and comedic theater, much of it around biblical story. And after Lee's death by suicide, laughter became difficult, which is not surprising in that sense. So it deals a little bit with the irony of Lee struggling with a mental illness that gave him spikes of mania as well as deep depression, all around these issues of telling, in essence, God's story. And that the return of that laughter through years of healing is part of why laughter becomes a sacred space. I should also say that there is hopefully plenty in the show that will make you laugh, and there would be plenty in the show that would make you feel and perhaps, hopefully, come with a sense of empathy. So that's sort of why the title, Laughter, Sacred Space.
And what basically do you try to impart in your show?
What I'm hoping to do is a number of things. The first of all is to help people in a community, perhaps if it's in a church community, in a congregation, to not see mental illness as something that is stigmatized and something that we can't talk about. So it's opening up a bit the conversation, pulling back the veil or the curtain a bit around mental illness, and that there are so many people that suffer and often suffer in silence. There's also a sense that just because you have a particular mental illness doesn't mean you can't be a fully functioning member of your community, something to deal with. That's one of the pieces. And the other is to give folks a sense of the relationship that Lee and I had and what happens when there's a traumatic loss in a relationship. In this case, a friendship and a working relationship, and how to walk through grief in a way that sometimes comedy and theatrical performances can help us see. In my case, it's not a how-to; it's perhaps how not to, and the meandering that I sort of did in that phase of grief. So many of us don't have a good sense of how to respond because, like many events in our lives, we don't know until we experience them. So there isn't a map, there isn't a game plan for what happens when you experience grief. And we as human beings are sort of set up in a way to experience loss because we are made to love, we are made to be in community, and we know that we are going to experience loss because we're all finite. It's that journey of grief and recovery.
Well, part of the problem with suicide is it's unexpected.
Exactly.
You have elderly grandparents, you figure they're going to die eventually, but when it's someone young and vital that's a big part of your life, it comes as a big shock.
Yeah. And it's what complicated it even more was that my livelihood was tied to him. A two-person company that all of our material is based on, all of the six or seven plays that we had that were based on our relationship. And I lost all of that in one time.
And Ted, this is Lisa here, and what a great opportunity for the Thumb, for the whole community that you will be presenting, and you know, obviously, through your grief journey, I mean, you have amazing insight and, you know, what you're able to do as far as putting that in a program that can reach so many. And so, I mean, obviously, you have touched on, you know, so much that we are trying to communicate or educate, you know, to the community.
Yes.
There's not a prescribed way to grieve. There's not an endpoint to the grieving, but it's really about trying to instill hope, trying to start healing, and educating so that the stigma is removed from, you know, obtaining mental health services, because,
yes,
you know, I'm sure it's close to 80 or 90% of people who die by suicide suffer with a major mental health issue, depression, bipolar, anxiety, schizophrenia.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Along the way. And the irony, you know, about the laughter and the sadness, or trying to, you know, maybe generate laughter, you know, laughter and sadness might, you know, come from the very same well as far as the passion and the depth. And so finding laughter, you know, or looking at it as sacred space. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
About laughter itself in that way?
About laughter and sacred space?
Yeah, sure. I think when Lee and I started our work, and when I started and continue to do the work, when you're working within a religious tradition, and in essence, we call it mucking around in sacred space, in this case, the scriptures that we hold dear, and sort of, we call it mucking around in a gentle way. What we try to do is find where the laughter was in that story, because when you find the laughter in a story, you usually find the depth to a story that you can't find in any other way. And I want to be clear that we never were making fun of something. We were putting ourselves as characters. And comedy is often created when someone doesn't understand what's going on. And that sort of became a through line as these characters were trying to understand what was happening to them as human beings. So that's one thing. That's how it became in our mind, say, this can be sacred laughter because it's based upon particular sacredness. I have grown, I think, an awful lot since that beginning, almost 30 years ago, to understand that laughter simply together with a group of people is creating a bond with them that is profound and almost completely unique. I believe I have the studies right that says you're likely 30 times more likely to laugh when you're with a group of people than you are by yourself. And if you think about it, well, that seems obvious. But on the other hand, if you think about what happens if the next time you're in a group of maybe 8 to 10 or even 300, and when there is a group laughter, what it does mostly physiologically, psychologically, not just the physical benefits. I think we know what that is. Opens your body up. There's also a metaphor for opening your soul, your mind. When you laugh together, you are doing yourself a physical favor. But what you're doing is you're opening your heart, your soul, and your mind, I think, in a way that is completely unique. And I believe that we are called to be in community with each other and connected to one another. And laughter is one of the great tools and I think one of the pillars of making that happen. And so hopefully what will happen in this particular show, like I think any good show that you would see, and I think any good theater production is going to have laughter in it regardless of whether it's called a comedy or not, because it's how we connect to one another. It's how we show our appreciation for each other. It's how we find an initial connection. I don't think I'm unique at all, but if I can be in a room and I can make someone laugh, then I know that we've already created some sort of bond, and I think many of us do that. It's an amazing thing, something we take for granted, something that we don't, I think, honor as much as what we should. This is somewhat tangential, but I think it's odd that there's been very, very few, maybe one or two films that have won Oscars that have been flat-out comedies.
Absolutely.
I just think that's odd.
And so what amazing insight you have about that, and a unique perspective about how we all share that commonality, or you know, how that resonates deeply. Like you said, when we're sharing a laughter, that is definitely a sacred space, and it affects you mentally, emotionally, physiologically, spiritually, that kind of connection to other people. So using this medium, you know, or to speak about your grief journey and then how you find laughter in sacred space and how that all, you know, how that sits with all of us. Just like what I said, it was a great opportunity for us to be able to hear and experience your presentation.
Yeah, I'm very, very, very happy to be there.
That's great.
Does the laughter part of it kind of counterpoint the sorrow that, you know, after a while it just seems almost normal that you've always got it? Does it help break that cycle?
Well, let me answer it this way. I think I understand the question. I think what happened for me in my relationship with Lee and creating laughter, obviously a relationship that you have with someone that becomes deep and long-lasting isn't all based on laughter. There's other things. If I'm also married to a woman that I've been with for 40 years, and that we do laugh, but there's plenty of other life that happens, obviously, beyond the always know that. So I think the show, in some ways, guess reflects that counterpoint that there were issues for Lee and I along the way. I think anytime you create a business, create a friendship, spend time on the road, deal with your own idiosyncrasies with one another, also deal with the fact that there was a mental illness to be negotiated and dealt with along the way, there was a connected through line for Lee and I, and that is that we just love making each other laugh. And we tried to communicate that on stage then the best we could. And that ebbed and flowed, obviously, depending on where Lee would have been in his illness. So for me, when Lee died, then there was a break in that sort of a natural flow, obviously. And my brother said at one point, as I went into a bit of a depression myself based on just the struggle and the grief and not dealing with it in the best ways possible, my brother said, you know, for the first time in his memory, I wasn't any fun to be around. And that's, I think, what happened. So there is a counterpoint, and the recovery of being able to laugh with your whole soul, your whole body, I think is a part of the journey.
We look forward to having you coming up to the Thumb area here. You're going to be performing at the Laker High School Auditorium. And admission is free and open to the public. What date is that?
September
17th. That, I believe, is September 17th.
September 17th.
And that's at 7 p.m. at Lakers. The show will begin, but please, we are opening the doors at 6 o'clock, providing refreshments, refreshments. And also we have several area mental health professionals, school representatives, and different people that will be providing information, you know, to people who are suicide survivors, but also we welcome the general public and also, you know, all members of the community to come and join. This is a no-cost event, and it's just, you know, obviously by hearing, you know, Ted Schwartz speak here about his presentation, it would really touch so many people and educate them in a profound way and increase awareness.
Well, Ted, we thank you for taking time with us today, and we hope you get a good turnout on the 17th.
I hope so, too. I'm looking forward to being there.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
We are back, and you do have another program coming up. We want to make sure we get that in, the one with Kevin Hines.
On September 29th at the Franklin Inn, we're presenting Kevin Hines, Cracked, Not Broken. Kevin's is an award-winning global speaker, an author, a filmmaker, suicide prevention and mental health advocate who reaches audiences with his story of an unlikely survival and a strong will to live. 2 years after Kevin was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, he attempted to take his life by jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge.
And not a subtle way.
No.
And I don't know if half a percent of the people survived that.
I don't think it's
suicide.
Even half.
Maybe not even half. So he does presentations across the United States as well, just really trying to appeal to young people and everyone about, you know, getting help for mental health issues. It's a no fee, but you do need to register.
And if you want to register for this event, call Carol at 989-269-9293.
Now, is there like a behavioral health or some clearing place that, you know, if you need help, they'll know all the services available locally? Is there some place on the web that you can go? Is there a directory or something? Because, you know, this is kind of a personal thing, and they're not going to be asking their neighbor and everything about this because, you know, they're kind of internalizing, I think, a lot of their survivor feelings as it is. Is there a place they can go like that that can get them the information on what is out there?
Well, definitely the Pigeon Mennonite Church. The nurse there and the pastor have been instrumental in, you know, setting up Laughter Sacred Space. These other two events, for sure, the Walk for Awareness, along with the Cracked But Not Broken presentation by Kevin Hines, those are sponsored by many different groups, but primarily the Huron County Behavioral Health, Huron County Suicide Prevention Coalition. So, you know, calling Carol, she will get you to the right person, which would be Kathy Harrison. I know as well, you know, that that Mary Greibel here is always giving information about suicide. I don't know, what is your contact information, Mary?
A lot of people refer people to me just because of the trainings I've had. I have a lot of resources. I can meet with families in their homes. I've had different trainings that I can go into the homes now immediately following a suicide. I have just a lot of outreach numbers and written resources that I can give people, and I can just share with them and kind of direct them in different ways. Mostly I'm just there to give comfort and hope and just to be a friend.
How can people contact you? Or
they can call me at 989-269-6269.
And for more,
and you mentioned Carol, sure. And her number is 269-9293, to ask for Carol, and she can clue you in on what services are available, support groups, everything around the area to help you at this time when you think nothing can help you.
Absolutely.
Well, I appreciate you folks coming out today and letting us know what's coming up. Three big events through the month of September locally. You've got the Walk, which is this Saturday.
This Saturday.
Then the following Saturday, you've got the Laughter is Sacred Space.
Correct.
With Ted. And then is this the following week?
September 29th.
It's a Thursday
morning. It's a Thursday morning.
And it's held at the Franklin Inn. And that is a 9 a.m. presentation.
Event.
Doors open at 8:30.
So that's 9 a.m. September 29th to hear from Kevin Hines. And that's at the Franklin Inn Bad Axe. And I hope the people who can benefit from this have heard us today, or friends tell them, and they can come take part of these programs and find out they're not in this all alone, that people have walked in their shoes and can help them find their path back to at least a more normal life. I don't know if you can ever get back to normal, but I think it'll help you at least have a life you can start to enjoy again.
And thank you, Craig, to you and WLEW for helping to get the word out and, you know, to care about, for sure, increasing awareness. And hopefully, even if we touch one life, you know, one life is saved, all of this is worth it.
And if you know someone and suspect something, say something to them. Yeah, maybe they just need a person to listen.
Can I give the hotline number?
Sure.
For suicide? Okay, it's 1-800-273-TALK or 1-800-273-8255. So if you suspect that somebody is suicidal or you yourself are having suicidal thoughts, please talk to them. You know, my recommendation is take that person to the emergency room where community mental health will provide emergency mental health services and do an assessment at that time.
Because to wait may be too late.
That's right.
I appreciate you taking time today,
thank
ladies.
You. Thank you so much.
And our guests today in the studios have been Lisa Shuttle. She's a clinical therapist with Thumb Area Psychological Services, leads a suicide support group. Also Mary Greibel. She is a survivor of suicide, lost a family member, and it's as hard as it gets, and volunteers to speak around the area to help others who are facing the same thing. I do want you to stay tuned. Coming up at the top of the hour, we will clue you in on all the latest in the news.